Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning. All right, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 23, 2023. We have five cases on our calendar today, three for oral argument. The first case is A220538, Senn versus Cass. Counsel, you are familiar with our proceedings. You each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. I'd ask that you state your name and the name of your client before you begin your argument this morning. The clock is on the podium. Please keep an eye on that clock. And these matters are being recorded. No other recordings are permitted. With that, counsel, anytime you're ready.
Do I use the middle podium?
You may use either one at your option.
Okay. Well, I like seeing how much time I have left, so I'm gonna stay here. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Graves. I am the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Ye Ying Senn. We are asking the court to reverse a trial court and remand a trial court decision from October of 2021, which denied the appellant's motion to set aside an oral stipulation, which was made in 2019, and also to set aside a judgment and decree, which was entered in February of 2022, based on the judge's order. Your Honor, it's our position
that... What would the remand be? Before you get into your argument, you said reverse and remand. What would the remand be?
The remand would be to reverse the denial of the... order that setting aside the order that vacated the oral stipulation. We're asking that that be vacated.
So remand for trial on all issues.
It would be remanded for trial, Your Honor, yes, absolutely, because the trial never got completed. It's our position, Your Honors, that the court abused its discretion in denying my client's motion. The parties were married for approximately 9 years. My client was 56 at the time of the divorce trial in 2019. She is from China. She is a native. She does speak fairly good English, but she is native Chinese, and that it's our position that, to a certain degree, that it affected her perception of the whole course of the litigation. What's very significant as well.
How do you reconcile that with the district court's credibility findings?
Well, Your Honor, the court, I mean, in fairness to my client, my client did not finish her direct examination. She was questioned, from what I can tell, because I was not the trial court counsel, but from what I can tell, she was not given an opportunity to speak fully, and... with all due respect, we think that the court erred in making that determination because part of it was based on his assumption or his belief that she completely understood everything that was going on.
When you say his belief, you mean the district court judge?
I'm sorry, the district court referee, yes. But at the same time, she had a guardian ad litem appointed for her.
The trial wasn't the first instance in which your client appeared before this referee. There were extensive proceedings.
Your Honor, I know that there were previous alternative dispute resolution processes, and that would have included what's called a moderated settlement conference, where I don't know to what extent Ms. Senn would have presented herself to the judge, because those are typically, it's just that the attorneys are having interaction with the court at that point. I'm not aware of any temporary orders. My opposing counsel may be better addressed to that, but as far as I know, except for what he saw at the trial, he's not going to know my client. And the other thing to remember is, everybody wants to appear polite. Everyone wants to appear like they are okay when they're in court, but that's not always the situation, and that's what happened here. So the legal process, Your Honor, there's a very clear legal analysis that the court has to use in a case like this. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in refusing to set aside the oral stipulation? In doing that, we look at the case of Tomczak versus Tomczak, 352 Northwest 2nd 464, and consider four different factors.
If I could ask you about this, because I think both parties acknowledge that you only need substantial compliance with these Tomczak factors. But do we look at that as a whole, or do we say, is there substantial compliance with factor number one? Do we go to number two? What does the case law tell us about that?
I think the case law tells us to consider all of the factors, Your Honor, and, you know, to what extent the factors were met and perhaps the unique circumstances of the case, how important would the different factors be? You know, in this case, there's no dispute that there was a stipulation in open court. There's no dispute that nobody ever asked my client, whether it was the judge or her attorney, whether she thought the agreement was fair and equitable.
Is there a legal requirement to do that when this isn't a Karen waiver sort of situation?
Well, the Tomczak case says yes. The Tomczak case says that, and this is with reference to the property settlement itself, Your Honor. That when questioned by the judge, the party is asked whether they understand that the terms of the agreement are fair and equitable. And as my client stated in her affidavit, she kept waiting for someone to ask her that question because she didn't feel that it was fair and equitable. And all of a sudden, everything was gone, or done. And I think, you know, that's one of the factors that we feel is very important in this case, especially when you consider that my client, the court had enough concerns about my client's mental capacity to appoint a guardian ad litem.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, I've gone back and read the appointment order, it's also, you know, a significant evidence available to the district court was the June 12th, 2019 report of the guardian ad litem, who not only, I mean, this person I think you would acknowledge is a well-recognized family law attorney who spent significant time not only chatting with your client, but your client's current lawyer, two previous lawyers, psychologist, met with your client along with the neutral financial analyst that the court had appointed. I mean, the guardian ad litem had pretty specific information about your client's capacity to understand, and I think indicates in that report it's not that she's not smart and doesn't understand. She understands the financial issues, that there are perhaps cultural barriers that make it difficult for her to participate in the process, but that's different than saying she didn't understand what the agreement was or what the underlying financial information was, isn't it?
Your Honor, it certainly is something that was appropriate for the trial court to consider. I would say that between June of 2019 and when the trial was heard, as my client's affidavit says, she did receive another infusion of a contrast agent called gadolinium as a part of an MRI that she received. And we provided medical evidence that can cause people to have, you know, experience issues like brain fog.
Or dizziness. I mean, the issue of dizziness was brought to the court's attention.
It was.
But during this trial, I mean, neither her lawyer or the guardian ad litem, who spoke with her directly during the course of the trial, expressed any concerns about brain fog or anything like that.
Well, they did talk about dizziness and that she might faint. But I think, Your Honor, that gets to one of the Tomczak factors. And that is, was my client provided effective counsel during this process? And certainly, you know, the attorneys are well known, and they under normal circumstances, they're, you know, this wouldn't be an argument. But in this particular situation, Your Honor, it's our position that the trial court, everybody was anxious to get this case over with. You know, she was a difficult client. They wanted, you know, they'd had to have a guardian ad litem appointed. So she was really being pressured and pushed, and all of the protections that should have been given her to make sure she was making a knowing decision were not made, in our opinion, it's provided in our brief. One thing that I noticed, Your Honors, when I was preparing for this argument today and looking at the trial court's order, is that I believe that to a large degree, his decision to deny the order is based on his belief that my client dissipated substantial marital assets during the course of the litigation. And specifically, if you go to finding of fact 10, which is in his order of October 25th of 2021, he talks about this. And he says, look, she dissipated over $800,000 worth of assets. However, at the time, you know, the trial court was basing that decision on only having heard Dr. Cass's testimony. The trial ended.
And the financial person had already testified, too.
But I don't believe the financial person they just provided information
numbers
about what the assets were.
Yep.
But the point is that finding of fact is clearly erroneous because it was not based on a full trial, and my client didn't have her opportunity to provide the testimony. And I think another factor
because this case settled, there's no findings by the court as to what the actual circumstances were or that there was actually dissipation. I read finding number 10 to just mainly be explaining that she understood what the numbers were and that there was some undisputed evidence that, you know, that she had withdrawn some money before the trial or before the dissolution or after it had just begun. But that the real finding and the guts of finding number 10 is the finding by the district court that her suggestion that she didn't understand the numbers was not credible.
Your Honor, I guess the way that I read it, and because there were several findings in the order, is that the judge believed, and I believe he may have even commented on this during our oral argument, that my client had dissipated marital assets. And the other fact is that, you know, because of the length of this litigation, which in part because of COVID and all the delays that occurred, a lot of the distributions had already occurred between the parties. And that is, in our opinion, that tainted the trial court's final decision that my client, you know, essentially saying, oh, she got a fair deal. You know, maybe all the Tomczak factors weren't met, but I think she got a good deal, and so we're not going to set it aside.
I just want to understand where you think that fits into our consideration of the Tomczak factors, because that's not a competence of counsel issue. I think the district judge was looking at this the wrong way. So is that going to that fair and equitable analysis? Help me with this.
Yes, I think it would be, Your Honor. You know, that it wasn't fair, you know, that, and that, you know, the I think the crux of what our argument deals with is the representation of counsel. And there are three questions that should have been asked my client that were not, or two at least. One is, are you under the influence of any drugs, alcohol, anything that could affect your ability to understand what was going on today? Nobody asked my client that question, even though clearly that issue had been brought up earlier. And I don't know why it wasn't asked, but it wasn't. And, you know, again, had my client been given the opportunity to answer that, we might not be here today. And the other part of it was, again, nobody asked her whether or not she thought the settlement, not just the maintenance part of it, because the maintenance part was kind of glossed over if you look at it and in the discussions. They didn't really, you know, I don't know how much she actually understood that she was waiving spousal maintenance. It wasn't clear to me. And again, I'm coming in like this court as a third party looking at the transcript.
Well, didn't she understand though? I mean, the question she asked, you know, were premised on the notion that I'm not going to get any more money. How am I going to pay off the mortgage on this house in North Carolina? So doesn't that suggest that she did understand there was not going to be spousal maintenance?
Well, I think what she was struggling to understand is how much money am I really getting? And I don't know that she ever, she didn't get a satisfactory answer. She didn't get the right answer, which is one of the arguments that we've made. The provision that requires her to pay off the mortgage, I mean, that's a pretty unusual provision in my experience as a family law attorney. Because essentially you're saying the money that you are supposed to use to support yourself, you've got to pay off a huge debt instead. And I don't think that she ever got a really good answer. And nobody ever went through that balance sheet with her. It's just, this is the balance sheet, Your Honor. Nobody ever went through it on the record, at least.
Right. I mean, we knew she had meetings along with the guardian ad litem with the
right
financial person. So
yeah, and you know, they came out and said, well, you're getting $861,000 when in fact, you know, if you look at what she had in her bank account, it was closer to about $600,000, which wouldn't have left her much if she's going to have to go back and pay this off. So, and I, there, one of the things that's raised in the appellant's brief is they claim, oh, but we did use the current figures in deciding what she was going to get. But if you look at its exhibit one, or excuse me, A, to the petitioner's, to Mr. Dr. Cass's affidavit, it shows that she's getting about $711,000 in liquid assets. But that was based on 2017 numbers and one account from 2019. And even that account didn't, which showed about $200,000, didn't reflect large payments of attorney's fees my client had to make after that. So she didn't have that. And I think, finally, Your Honor, just to point out that there were important issues that were that were never resolved in this stipulation. They never there was no disagreement on attorney's fees, division of household goods and furnishings, and my client, who was getting health insurance through Dr. Cass, none of that was ever discussed. She's pretty much been left on her own to try to figure that out since then. So based on that and all of the Tomczak factors, we are asking the court to reverse the trial court's decision and reverse this matter back. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Counsel, anytime you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor, and because of my stature, I'm going to use this.
You can move that up and down. There's a little button at the bottom that allows you to lift it and lower it if you'd like.
You know, I'm going to just get on with my
That's just fine. At your preference, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Jane Binder, and I represent the respondent, Oliver Cass. Your Honors, this is a case of buyer's remorse and nothing else. We had a three-day trial, and an agreement was read into the record at the end of the second day. But we hadn't just been negotiating that day. We had been negotiating for 2 years. We had financial expert. We had mediations. We had moderated settlement conferences. And after agreeing on the record to this settlement, appellant decided she wanted more. She's not accepting responsibility for what she agreed to, and she's twisting facts and providing information after the fact to try to show that the Tomczak factors were not met. The standard of review, of course, is abuse of discretion. This court is to give deference to the trial court's decision, and here, as one of you pointed out, this judicial officer had the benefit of presiding over this case for 2 years. I was the attorney of record from the beginning. We did appear before the judicial officer at least two times, and the record it would show, but at least two times before the trial. The trial court was also not basing his credibility determinations in the order that's on appeal just on affidavits, but on watching the trial for almost all of 2 days. And contrary to what counsel said, the main witness in those 2 days was the appellant. I don't think the respondent testified for an hour before we broke for to engage in settlement negotiations. And all of the testimony, not all, but most of the testimony was my cross-examination of the appellant about her spending between the time the case started and the time of trial. So the trial judge knows this case, knows these parties. The trial court obviously carefully considered appellant's motion. He wrote a detailed and thoughtful order, 18 pages, 50 findings of fact, and found appellant's claims not credible in several findings of fact, notably 9, 13, 21, and 34.
What about finding of fact number 10? That seems to be the one that appellant cites in particular to show that that in fact this settlement wasn't fair and equitable, and the district court based its sort of implicit acceptance of the settlement as fair or at least not improvidently made on the sense that the numbers fall in the way that you assert they are, when in fact they have no there's no finding by the district court as to what right. the financial information really was at the time.
First of all, I think we're talking about finding 9. Finding 10 is about having a written settlement. And okay. Just so I'm clear, I don't want to.
Yes, you're right. I'm talking about 9. I think I got 10 from you. Sorry.
Okay.
Yes, I'm looking at it right now.
I read this as the court saying, and I haven't read it, you know, this minute, but that she was facing a dissipation claim, a potential loss of all this money that she had spent over the course of the case. And that, and he goes through the testimony about this $227,000 check that she didn't cash and then she did. And he's saying, I think that this is an equitable result for her. And she understood what she, you know, the final sentence is, she understood the nature of her agreement and that the amount of money she would have because she had testified about it for the past 2 days. That's how I read it. I don't see it as a finding of fact, but, it's a finding of fact, of course, but it's the court, it's more information that the court is relying on to say she knew what she was doing and she knew what she was agreeing to. The court also found that she met the test for capacity. She had the capacity to understand to a reasonable extent the nature of the proceedings and the capacity to participate in them. That was finding 23, 24, and 37.
I think that counsel's argument is that the district court did not have sufficient evidence to be able to make that finding. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, first of all, the district court's in the best position to assess credibility. You know, there's lots of case law on that. Second of all, and especially when he's had so much experience with this group. Also, given her credibility claim, the fact that he did not find her credible, in fact, she talked about a chambers meeting we had before the trial started in her affidavit, which didn't happen. There were a lot of things that made the court find that her claims weren't credible. Her gadolinium argument that she had brain fog, that's contradicted by the evidence. At the beginning of trial, her counsel stood up and said, "My client might be dizzy, might faint," and the court asked her if she wanted to be there. She said, "I'm happy to be here." He said, If you're not feeling well, tell your guardian, tell me, tell your lawyers, and we'll stop. There was no point in those 2 days that she ever mentioned she didn't feel well, and she was dismissed or anything. Also, then she comes in after the fact and has medical records from people who saw her long after the trial who are extrapolating that she might have felt this and she might have felt that, which is not evidence. So there was no claim. That's her biggest capacity argument. There's the guardian ad litem and the court both found that her English is fine. You know, the judge watched her testify for 2 days, and he said in his order, other than, you know, normal nervousness, she seemed to understand everything that was going on during the trial.
But here's what concerns me. Having read through this transcript more than once, her series of questions and expressions of, "I'm not going to have enough money. I don't understand. I'm not going to have this money," and her concern about that. I mean, it doesn't. And you say that's not well founded, and the district court found that was not credible because, in fact, the district court knew she understood or found that she understood what the financial situation was. But don't her series of questions and her statements about not understanding and concern about money, I mean, isn't that sort of consistent with the position she took within days of the settlement, that I didn't have enough information. I'm not comfortable with what happened. I don't think I was well represented. I mean, can't you read those things together and say, you know, maybe there is something to this argument that she lacked capacity or information to proceed?
I see that as not atypical of somebody at the end of a case wanting to understand what they're going to get. And she was receiving a vast majority of the marital assets, and she wanted to understand what she was going to have. And I think the fact that she asked those questions shows that she did understand. And the Pekarek case addresses the fourth Tomczak factor about whether it's imperative that they be asked if it's fair and equitable. And in that case, it was also the wife, was asking a lot of questions, and the courts found that she, but never asked her if it was fair and equitable, and still found that the agreement she reached, she knew what she was doing.
Did
ask questions.
But are there any cases, including Pekarek and the other ones you cite in your brief, involving parties who are subject to a guardian ad litem appointment?
Well, I think
doesn't that make a difference for our assessment?
I mean, I think it could, but I don't think in this case it does. If you look at the appointment order appointing the guardian, she was appointed to help prepare for trial. And initially it was thought she needed a guardian because she wasn't cooperating with discovery. And then it was just to help prepare for trial and so that she'd understand. And the fact that she had two attorneys during the two-day trials and a guardian ad litem, all respected, highly respected family law attorneys, I don't know how she couldn't understand what she was agreeing to. They were advising her. Of course, it's not on the record. Nobody says on the record, you know, I mean, unless it's that detailed of an agreement and there's nothing in writing. But of course they discussed it back in their room during the settlement negotiations that day and, of course, for months before that. So, appellant has not met the Tomczak factors. The argument that appellant was not represented by competent counsel or had ineffective counsel just doesn't work. She argues duress. Well, duress is when somebody is threatened, and there's no evidence that her attorneys or anyone else threatened appellant into settling. And in Kroeplin, Kroeplin v. Haugen, this court held that mere pressure that a party feels during trial to reach a settlement does not amount to duress. If she felt pressure to settle, that's not duress. There's also the argument that she wanted a settlement, but not this settlement. Well, if you look at pages 59 to 60 of appellant's addendum, her attorney says very specifically what she's receiving and that she won't be receiving maintenance, and also on 61. And he said, do you understand that? And she says, I do. And later he says, is this the settlement you want the court to order today? And she says, yes. That's not someone who's saying, well, I want a settlement, but not that settlement. And the argument that she was waiting to be asked if it was fair and equitable and waiting to be asked if she was influenced by drugs or alcohol, you know, who knows what she was thinking at the time? That's easy to say in hindsight when you're attacking an agreement. But this was a woman who spoke up when she needed something. She asked questions, as you pointed out, Your Honor. And if she really wanted to say, wait a minute, she could have done so. She did that during the trial. She did it during the settlement. So it's easy to say she was waiting to be asked a certain question, and she knows now how she would have answered that. But I think that's speculation at best. Under the argument, too, that she didn't know what her bottom line was and that that she'd have to pay attorney's fees, I've addressed that in the brief, and it's clear she knew what the bottom line was going to be approximately. I mean, nobody knows exactly when you settle a case because market forces can change things and spending out of accounts can change things. And she did, I would say, 100% of the spending. So she should have known what was coming out of those accounts. And counsel says that these are old values, but we relied on Exhibit 262, which was prepared by appellant's counsel and appellant and our financial expert. And three accounts were updated to May of 2019. And those had hundreds of thousands of dollars that were no longer represented when we reached our settlement. So she got the benefit of all of that, and we used the updated numbers. The others were like retirement accounts and things that wouldn't change over time. So it's not true that these were outdated numbers and she wasn't informed what she was really getting, because it was all right there as her counsel had prepared. And my client agreed to rely on that to get the case settled. Your Honors, this case has been going on for six years, since 2017 is when it started. And at the time of the agreement, Dr. Cass, the respondent, simply wanted two things. He wanted his name off the mortgage on the house that Ms. Sen so desperately wanted, and he wanted to be done. He wanted the divorce to be over. The appellant has received every piece of property that she was awarded in the settlement she's trying to repudiate, and done none of her responsibilities. She hasn't finalized the divorce, and she hasn't paid off the mortgage or otherwise refinanced it.
Counsel, your time has expired. If you just want to briefly summarize, and
we'd like this litigation to end. Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you very much, counsel. Ms. Graves, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Just a couple quick points, Your Honor. I think Ms. Binder made my point about concern about the trial court over-reliance on the observation or belief that my client had dissipated substantial marital assets, so why should I give you a second crack at the apple? Because if the entire testimony, that most of the testimony he'd heard for the one day of trial was being cross-examined and accused by opposing counsel of dissipating, and she didn't have an opportunity to present her own testimony. So the problem with those findings of fact, it's finding of fact 9 and 43, is that they were made without the benefit of a full record, which we believe makes them clearly erroneous. As far as the on the issue of my client's capacity, again, I think it's totally inconsistent to say that my client understood everything and had the capacity needed, but yet she needed to have a guardian ad litem appointed. Rule 1702 says that a guardian ad litem is appointed shall be appointed for someone who is incompetent. And if that was the case, then why was she still having a guardian ad litem at the time of the trial, who continued until after the judgment and decree was entered? And I believe she even signed off on the original judgment and decree that had been prepared. There was a question about my client's lack of credibility because she cited a Chambers meeting, which counsel said never occurred. It appears based on the, if you look at a respondent's brief, that in fact that discussion took place in open court. When my client signed her affidavit, it was 2 years later. Her memory may have been mistaken. I don't necessarily remember what was going on in a courtroom 2 years ago, so I don't believe that that's sufficient to attack her credibility. And I would just finally note that as far as all of my clients, getting everything that she was supposed to, she never got all of her household goods and furnishings, Your Honor, because that issue was never decided. And there's a lot of memories, a lot of family stuff that she didn't get because that issue was never addressed by the trial court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is taken under advisement. We will issue our opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much, counsel, for the very helpful arguments.